itself.
Across the sea of space, the stars are others, and we have traveled this way before, and there is much to be learned.
Hello and welcome. Tis I, Dawn, your political scientist and skeptical philosopher. Today's harangue is about terrorists. Not the bad kind that blow up things, but the fakers. Okay, I should provide context for this rant. I am glad the Olympics are over and no harm was done. That said, of all the gangs, this was going to be the one that went boom, i.e. terrorist attacks. The host nation is responsible for much of the atrocities in the world, well, at least in their local area. The host nation has also been the victim of many previous terrorist attacks. Remember the theater hostage taking in Moscow, where 130 hostages died, the seizing of a school in Beslan, where over 380 people died. In the lead-up to the Olympics, we had bombers that were attacking train stations. On top of that, the region where the games are taking place is right next door to Chechnya, Dagestan, Azerbaijan. In fact, most of the southern Russian territories are involved in conflict of one way, be it active ethnic, regional, or Islamic insurgents and terrorist campaigns. In fact, you had the main leader of the Chechen Islamists, Mr. Umarov, openly call for a massive wave of terrorist attacks during the game. And we got nothing. Again, it's good that all went well, but one must wonder, is terrorism dead? Well, no, but the big international boogeyman that every nation in the world, even our own, goes by the tag known as terrorism with a capital T, he is, well, it seems to be just a figment of our collective imaginations. Now, I'm not denying that there are terrorists out there, but those are tactics employed by people, not some amorphous group called terrorist, who are bent on destroying all that is good in the world. Since 9/11, the term terrorist has been equated and conflated to something like the Illuminati or the Umbrella Corporation, and it's not. Terrorism is a tactic used in asymmetric conflicts. Asymmetric is a fancy word for saying one-sided. It's what happened when the French resistance fought the Nazis. They had no planes or tanks, so they planted bombs by the side of roads, they blew up restaurants where Nazis frequented, etc. It's what the IRA did to Britain, Afghans to the Soviets, and then the Yanks, and if we go back far enough, the Brits. It's what the Palestinians use against Israel, the Basque against Spain, and many democratic movements against numerous dictatorships. We are taught now that terrorism, again capital T, is a global plot against democracy, freedom, and the American way. Well, okay, the Yankees are a bit imperialistic, so let's give that last one a pass. But we're told that they hate our freedom. Yet, if you look at the numbers, the vast number, by orders of magnitude, of terrorist attacks are done by separatists. These are people who feel, justly or not, oppressed by their federalist government and believe that they'd be better off on their own. Now, in the case of Canada, there may have some practical implications, i.e. during the FLQ period. The FLQ, for those too young to know, were our own homegrown terrorists, especially active in the October crisis of 1970, who resorted to violence to, quote, liberate Quebec from an Anglophone tyranny in Ottawa. This was not some group who hated Canada and want everyone to speak French and eat poutine. Well, now that I think about it, they were kind of successful on the poutine part. Poutine. Anyway, it was a small local fringe group, as are all terrorists. Their identity was not derived from terrorism, capital T, but some local regional conflict where the only viable, if immoral, option for resistance is the tactic of terrorism, small t. I am still disappointed, in a guilty, totally inappropriate way, in that NASCAR crash sense. I'm disappointed that nothing happened during the Olympics, and I'm sure the uber-oppressive tactics of the resurrected Tsar state of Russia help suppress the genuine local activist. I cannot help but wonder if the U.S. had a better precedent, if its reaction to 9/11 was less radical and more mature, that we would not be living in this state of faux fear. If after 9/11 the message was not, we're under attack by global conspiracy that will use anything and every opportunity and weakness to kill us all, if that was not the opportunistic message, but if instead the government had come out with a more mature, reassuring message, one that was intended to reduce people's sense of fear and insecurity. If they said something like, major tragedy happened. It was a random, unique event. We'll be more vigilant, but this event is like a hurricane. We learn from it, we rebuild, and we continue to live the American dream. The attack on the American dream was not terrorism. It was not this global nightmare that we've been led to believe. But it's the sense of paranoia and fear that the government reactions to it has left. That has killed the American dream. And along with it, everyone's sense of security. These Olympics help prove the fallacy of their message of fear. Wake up America, wake up Canada. The only threat we face is the growing autocracy that has replaced the democracy we once enjoyed and loved. There will be a reckoning. Never forget 2015. We will return after this break with a long look at the value of neoliberal free trade.
Subscribe to the Radio Freethinker podcast and take it on the go and download previous episodes. Subscribe via iTunes or at RadioFreethinker.com. Remember to like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at CITRRFT. If you have any questions, comments, or thoughts to share with us, email at info@RadioFreethinker.com. Understanding empowers you.
Welcome back. Well, the Free Trade Agreement, also known as CAFTA, was signed into existence 25 years ago, and its offspring, NAFTA, turned 20 this year. These have been much-touted examples of the glories of free trade. Currently, there are negotiations underway to create a Pacific Ocean version of this called the Trans-Pacific Partnership, or TPP. I thought, in the light of the TPP, it might be interesting to see what we have learned from NAFTA and the free trade experiment. Now, of course, it is hard to attribute praise or fault to any one trade agreement in a globalized market, but with that caveat being said, let's begin. To refresh memories, the first big free trade agreement was conveniently named the Free Trade Agreement. Not much hiding in that title. This was negotiated at the time between Mulroney in Canada and Reagan in the USA. Famously, there was a federal election in 1988 that was deemed a referendum on free trade. Sadly, even though the PCs lost seats and the anti-free trade liberals doubled theirs, it was, however, not enough and Mulroney won the election and free trade became a reality. So what is free trade in general? Really, the British were the first to support the idea of international free trade. In the 18th and 19th century, the British Empire was at its height. England was shopkeeper to the world, and they felt that if there was no barriers to trade, they could outcompete anyone and thus rule the world economically as well as militarily. Much of the early conflict between the US and Britain was over the idea of free trade. Britain loved it, while the not yet superpower US wanted to protect its own native industries from predatory competition from the likes of Britain. The free trade agreement signed between Canada and US had two really major points for our discussion. Trade disputes would be adjudicated by a binational panel, the rulings of this panel would be binding, and the tariffs and duties on a wide range of products would be eliminated. What was notable about CAFTA was the exemptions. East Coast fishing, magazine postage, and even beer productions were allowed to keep their pre-agreement regulations that favored Canada. And the auto pack, which has much favored Canada, was left intact. The U.S. got some exemptions, but we're not Yankees, so let's move along. The results of this agreement saw Canada exports to the U.S. rise from 25 to 40%. It also saw a dramatic increase in, quote, investments in Canadian resource sector. However, it was the value of the Canadian dollar that had the biggest influence on trade between nations during the 90s. This brings up the spawn of free trade, NAFTA, or the North American Free Trade Agreement. Again, not the most inventive of names. NAFTA expanded free trade both geographically, it would include Mexico, but also sort of subjectively, that is, it would regulate more things. NAFTA started in 1992, again with Mulroney for Canada, Bush Sr. for the US, and Salinas for Mexico. Although by the time it was signed in 1994, the U.S. was headed by Bill Clinton, and Canada had two seat changes, with a brief premiership of Kim Campbell and the long-term tenure of John Chrétien. This agreement impacted Mexico the most by eliminating all of its import-export barriers, as had already sort of taken place between Canada and the U.S. with the initial free trade agreement. NAFTA was really a trade agreement between the U.S. and Mexico, with Canada tacked on as sort of an afterthought. In fact, there was actually no single NAFTA agreement for agriculture, but three separate bilateral agreements. It also addressed intellectual property rights. However, it did not address in any significant way immigration. NAFTA allowed for the free flow of capital, money, between nations while not allowing the people to do the same. Have you ever wondered why there are so many Americans trying to cross the border into the U.S.? It's not because of Yankee hospitality. They're following the jobs. The Mexican economy did gain in some niche areas, think strawberries, tomatoes. But their agricultural grain sector was decimated by subsidized crops and meats from the U.S. via the American Farm Bill. Even in success areas like beer, the raw product that was used to brew was imported from the United States. And with, quote, foreign investment buying these companies, the profits were also exported along with the beer. Mexico went from a mostly self-sufficient company vis-a-vis food to a very dependent one, with over half of its food being imported, and items like wheat up to 70%. This makes Mexico very vulnerable to global fluctuations in food pricing. But again, we're talking about Canada. What has this trade deal done for us? Well, first, there's been a large amount of foreign investment coming into the country since the trade agreement. However, this investment has not been to launch new enterprises or develop unused resources, but has been used in the acquisition of Canada's economic crown jewels, Inco, Elcan, Stelco, Falconbridge, and let's not forget, the oil and gas industry is now largely in the hands of foreign companies. Of the 100 largest private companies in Canada, beginning with General Motors and ending with Rolls-Royce, 67 are foreign-owned. In 1997, there were 41 large Canadian petroleum companies. Today, there are only 6, and of the 35 that no longer exist, U.S. companies bought 21. It's important to note that there's not really a single major industry in the United States that is majority foreign-owned. We are a resource company, and yet the top 10 most valuable brands in Canada, 5 of them are banks, 2 are telecoms. There is Bombardier and Weston, the bread people, but only one energy company. Now, depending on what sources you use, you may get a different set of companies, but none of them will have many Canadian-owned resource companies on that list because they are an endangered species. And much of this investment is not at the net benefit of Canada. In a story we reported a while ago, Caterpillar bought Electromotives of London, Ontario, and then promptly shut it down and moved it south of the border to Indiana, a low-wage state. It's actually kind of a sad state of affairs that areas in the U.S. have replaced places like Bangladesh as destinations for cheap labor. Of all of the over $500 billion in foreign direct investment monitored by the Investment Review Division between 1985 till 2003, a startling 96.7% has been for takeovers of companies in Canada, and a pathetic, paltry 3.3% have been used for new business investments. As our economies become more entwined, so have other aspects. As part of the Americanization of Canada has included deregulation, privatization, and harmonization of our laws and practices with theirs, as more and more CEOs of, quote, Canadian companies are American or other foreign nationals, their concerns for Canada as a nation and people become secondary. This influence has also occurred in cultural aspects. Yes, in some ways, Canada was a winner with the opening of Hollywood North, but the movies, the shows, the stories are not Canadian. The most popular shows on TV are not Canadian. The CBC has been gutted and laid withered. When I was growing up, there was a strong sense of identity, and not just hockey and Tim Hortons. It was the nature of things, the national, Canada AM, Nick and Jesse and the Beachcombers, and icons like Mr. Dress-Up. Now, I understand with 1,000 TV channels to choose from, there is no more one thing everyone is watching right now kind of moments, like you had prior to the 90s. That said, those south of the border are still mostly watching American content. And so are we, watching American content. It's not ours. It does not reflect our unique identity. But let's get back to NAFTA 20. Now, some have pointed out that Canadian exports to the U.S. have increased under free trade, and it's true that in the 90s, our exports went from 15% to a peak of 34%. But since the turn of the millennium, that number has shrunken to 18%, about where we started. Our manufacturing sector has declined, and unlike our energy exports, which have skyrocketed, well, non-energy exports have cratered. There's been stagnation in wages. Unions have been cowed by the very real threat from management, do what we say, or we'll pack up and move south. And while our exports are good overall, we still have a trade imbalance, i.e., as exports increased, imports increased more. Haven't already touched on the fact that foreign investment in Canada was really about foreign takeover Canadian companies, another effect is to concentrate industries into fewer and fewer competitors. The average firm size of the 60 largest corporations on the Toronto Stock Exchange, the TSX 60, compared to all the firms registered on the TSX, increased slightly from about 5 times to 6 times between 1950 and 1990. However, it has increased 23 times by 2010. While the TSX 60 companies' share of total revenue of all TSX companies has remained the same before and after NAFTA, hovering about 20%, their share of TSX company profits rose from 30 to 60% by 2010. Another as yet often skirted affect or effect of NAFTA is the surrendering of sovereignty from the national government to the trade panels. Ultimately, any trade dispute is not adjudicated in Parliament or the courts, but by a trade panel of lawyers, corporate lawyers. For example, when Canada tried to end the use of leaded gas in Canada because of lead's damaging effect on the brain, to the point where one researcher believes the drop in crime over the last 20 years is due to the elimination of leaded gas, when we tried to outlaw it in 1997, we, i.e. Canada, was sued by the Ethyl Corp of California. They invoked the Expropriations Clause, Article 110, of the investment chapter of NAFTA to sue the government for $350 million for damages and lost income. With the NAFTA agreement working exactly as it was designed to, the pressure of significant potential public liability mounted on the federal government, and on July 20, 1998, it backed down, settling out of court before the NAFTA arbitration panel could rule. In a final cruel irony, the $19.5 million compensation paid to Ethyl for lost profits and legal costs exceeded the total 1998 Environment Canada budget for enforcement and compliance programs, which was $16.9 million. The government also issued a statement to the effect that the manganese-based additive is neither an environmental nor a health risk, which, of course, Ethyl used to market MMT internationally. One should note as well that Ethyl sued not for lost profits per se, but potential profits. Here is an important part. As we become more global, as in one world governance, nations will have to give up part of their power or sovereignty. It in of itself, I have little issue with. But who are we giving it up to? Is it some global parliament or some multinational corporation who can manipulate, quote, local governments to do their bidding? I fear that democracy on a global scale is decades in the future. However, one world governance via corporocracy is a current reality. It's curious to hear on the 20th anniversary of NAFTA, Mexican and American activists decrying how bad it was and how each country was the big loser in the deal. So at best, free trade seems to be sort of a net zero, and at worst, the destroyer of the heart of our nation and turned us into a bananic republic. Well, most likely it's somewhere in between. Now you might say, hey Don, NAFTA and all that, like that's like old news, move on already. As sadly that may be true, if it were not for the next iteration of the free trade called Trans-Pacific Partnership, or the TPP. Officially, the TPP is, to quote our government, an initiative that is driving regional economic integration and setting new rules for how trade is negotiated on a broader scale. Wikipedia says the TPP intends to enhance trade and investment amongst the TPP partner countries, promoting innovation, economic growth, and development, and supporting the creation and retention of jobs. It is currently being negotiated between Australia, Brunei, Chile, Canada, Japan, Malaysia, Mexico, New Zealand, Peru, Singapore, the United States, and Vietnam. The TPP, I guess, like CAFTA and NAFTA before it, has sparked a groundswell of resistance. Those previous revolts were largely based on elements in the treaty. What makes the TPP different is the secrecy surrounding the agreement, and that secrecy being its number one Achilles heel. How secret, you may say? Well, here's the words of one congressman. Quote, "The majority of Congress is being kept in the dark on the substance of the TPP negotiations. While representatives of U.S. corporations like Halliburton, Chevron, Pharma, Comcast, and the Motion Picture Association of America are being consulted and made privy to the details of the agreement, more than 2 months after receiving the proper security credentials, my staff is still barred from viewing the details of the proposal that the government is advancing. We hear that the process by which the TPP is being negotiated has been a model of transparency. I disagree with the statement. If our legislators can't see what's going on, and the public is kept even more in the dark, how are we to know if this agreement is good or bad? Now, one must wonder, what are they hiding? Well, they are hiding it from you and me, and the politicians at least, but the corporations are not only getting to see and read it, but they also seem to be writing as well. I can perhaps understand why you might want to consult with corporations and industry. Hell, some of these companies have bigger budgets than most of the nations involved in the treaty. But why not let the elected officials see the details? Let the public know. And here it's important to note that this is not a trade agreement, but an investment agreement. That is, it is not so much worried about the flow of goods between nations, but the flow of capital. Now, thanks to WikiLeaks, we actually do have a glimpse at what is going on with these trade agreements. We have been able to actually see what they're trying to hide from us. And the majority of the agreement seems to have nothing to do with trade and everything to do with intellectual property rights, trademark, copyrights, patents. It will make it an international norm that although you may own the rights to a digital copy of a song and can legally play it on various digital devices, the software to actually allow you to take your iTunes movie and move it to some media streamer to play, well, the software will be illegal. It is equivalent to saying you can go to any room in your house. It's just you can't go through any doorway. It will also extend copyrights to the life of the author plus 70 for works created by individuals, and either 95 years after publication or 120 years after the creation of corporate-owned works, something like Mickey Mouse. These excessive periods are not to help struggling artists. They get actually very little money from this. No, excessive copyrights only ensure the monopoly of corporations at the detriment of cultural growth. Ever wonder why you no longer hear Happy Birthday on TV shows? Its copyright was bought by Warner Chappell Music in 1988, and they've been really very litigious ever since. The fact, of course, that the song originated in the late 1880s, and yet they still claim copyright protection? Why? The TPP will also place more restrictions on fair use. Fair use is where you can use a copyrighted material for things like criticism, comment, news reporting, teaching, scholarship, and research. It will also help propagate excessive fines for illegal downloads. Let us not forget the American woman who was fined $220,000 for downloading 20 songs. That's like $11,000 per song. It will also extend patents on drugs even when only cosmetic changes are made. Right now, to extend a patent, the drug company must show a significant improvement. The new and improved version must really be improved, and not just have the color of the pill changed. After TPP, new color renews your patent and makes it unaffordable for the poor even longer. It will make more civil suits become criminal suits, most notably around the area of fair use and copyright infringement, which are now largely dealt with by civil courts. These will now be escalated to criminal courts. Perhaps more controversial, it will harmonize patents on life forms and their biological processes. This will include medical procedures and treatment, i.e., this would put a patent on heart surgery. Anyone wanting heart surgery is going to first have to pony up the licensing fee. It will also strengthen patents on GMOs. Surprisingly for a trade agreement, and actually stops trade. One of the ironies we know fairly well here in Canada is the Yanks pay a lot for drugs. We think we do, but our healthcare system is allowed to negotiate with pharmaceutical companies for better deals. The US equivalents are not. So we get a discount, and they don't. This has led to cross-border shopping, where ill Americans cross the border to buy medication here, which will save them quite a bit of money, and sometimes the costs are 2, 3, or 10 times more expensive in the States. Well, this trade will explicitly forbid that. It's called parallel trade. The TPP will place a ban on parallel imports of genuine goods acquired from other countries without the authorization of the copyright holder. On a side note, in my research, I came across one line that made a point that said that the TPP will, quote, make a commitment to deregulate public services. But I couldn't find anything more on that. So if any of our listeners can find out more, let me know and email us at info@radiofreethinker.com. So what is the whole point of trade agreements? It's to get cheap goods. But really, it's not that we want cheap goods. We want to be able to buy more goods. Those two things are not the same thing. Let me explain. Let's pretend I make widgets. A widget costs $10. I make $20 an hour. I like widgets, so I spend all my money buying widgets. So every hour, I get to buy 2 widgets. Now, a new company comes in and says, hey, we sell widgets for $6.50. They're made in China, but they're just as good. Yay, I might say at first. Now I can buy 3 widgets per hour. Except a little later, my company moves its production to China to compete. I get laid off and my new job only pays $10 an hour. Now I can only afford 1 widget per hour. So cheaper is not always better. If we focus only on the business and not on the community in which it is attached, we can find ourselves up a creek without a paddle. If we look at the average income of workers over the past 30 decades, we see a complete stagnation. That is, when adjusted for inflation, the average home is making about the same amount today as it did in 1984. And that's not factoring in things like now most homes have 2 wage earners at least and are working more hours. That is not the case for the investor class. While working wages have stagnated, quote, returns on investment, the earnings of the 10% have skyrocketed. And they can largely thank the trade agreements that have made capital free while enslaving workers. And here we return to the other big issue with the TPP, is who is doing the negotiations. It seems it's not so much our politicians, but the multinational corporations who seem to have the pen in these negotiations. Now, there is a thing called overreach, and maybe we have an example. Not all politicians are subservient to their corporate masters as the American and Canadian ones seem to be. And it has been reported that the TPP is largely being pushed by the Yanks, but it seems some nations are putting their society before the economy, the people before profits. So there has been pushback by other nations. There's also been enough pushback by rogue politicians and the public at large to perhaps delay or even kill the TPP. It is remarkable the silence that the mainstream media has had on this issue. But the alternative media has definitely made up for it and has made itself be heard quite loudly. It does not hurt matters either that although multinational corporations like the TPP, not all businesses are multinational. Some actually depend on sort of a healthy society. They need people who can actually afford their goods. The U.S., as I said, is one of the ones pushing this agreement most, but may not actually pass it if it ever gets signed for one of the most laughable reasons possible, and that is Obama. The Republican Party in the U.S. so hate Obama that they will not let anything he's in favor of pass, especially a major history-making trade deal like this. So they have pretty much killed the idea of fast track. Fast track in the U.S. is where the president negotiates the deal, then presents it to the Senate for a sort of simple up-down vote. If it is not fast-tracked, then the Senate can add amendments, which, beyond the complications with 4 governments, will also likely include an amendment to repeal Obamacare. So, much like the League of Nations, where the U.S. took the lead, but ultimately did not pass a treaty they themselves started, well, it's a sad day indeed, but perhaps with a good endnote. I guess I should wrap this up with bringing up the issue of giving up sovereignty to neutral panels who will have the power to amend or rescind laws a duly elected government enacted. Australia right now is dealing with one of those panels where tobacco giant Philip Morris is suing Australia over freedom of speech because in an effort to discourage smoking, all branding has been removed from cigarettes in Australia. The mechanism for ultimately ruling who is right or wrong will be something called the Investor State Dispute Settlement, or ISDS. There is no appealing this group, beyond, of course, pulling out of the trade agreement altogether. The ISDS is, well, here is what George Mandelbot, reporter for The Guardian, said. The TPP would allow a secretive panel of corporate lawyers to override the will of parliaments and destroy our legal protections. The rules are enforced by panels which have none of the safeguards we expect on our own courts. The hearings are held in secret. The judges are corporate lawyers, many of whom work for companies of the kind whose case they will be hearing. Citizens and communities affected by the decision have no legal standing. There is an innate conflict of interest when a lawyer judge may be in the past or possibly in the future employed by the litigants. It is epidemic in the States where the head of a regulatory agency will retire. They get hired by the same company they were charged for regulating. Then later on, get rehired by the government to oversee or advise on regulations over the same companies they were just working for. So, it seems like a very bad idea for Canada. And fortunately, the Americans are so dysfunctional, it looks like the deal this time will be dead in the water. Until at least the next president. We'll be back after this break.
Today in the news.
And today in the news.
Today in the news.
Tired of the same few voices giving you the same point of view on the news? You're not alone. The Campaign for Democratic Media is a nonpartisan, nonprofit group fighting to ensure that our public airwaves represent more than just one voice. Canadians deserve diverse, accountable, and quality Canadian media. Visit democraticmedia.ca to learn how you can stand up for media issues.
And we're back. Some people make claims about miracle cures, alien visitation, ghosts, perpetual motion machines. Well, the list of woo is endless. But when I push back on these claims, I'm often called closed-minded. So I heard a great explanation of what open-mindedness really is and what it is not. Spoiler, pot calling the kettle black. This clip is courtesy of Qualia Soup. Subscribe on YouTube if you like it.
It seems to be an extremely common experience amongst people who don't believe in certain non-scientific concepts to be told by others who do to be more open-minded. This advice is typically based on highly flawed thinking, including an inaccurate understanding of what open-mindedness is. In fact, being open-minded simply means being willing to consider new ideas. Science promotes and thrives on open-mindedness because the advancement of our understanding about the reality in which we exist depends upon our willingness to consider new ideas. Indeed, scientific discovery often requires entirely new ways of thinking. However, not only does believing in certain non-scientific concepts not automatically make you open-minded, it can often lead you to be the complete opposite. A neighbour of mine once noticed a moving lampshade in my front room and said it was a ghost. When I told him it wasn't, he said, "You've got the evidence in front of you," and said I was stubbornly closed-minded and had no curiosity. When he'd finished his little outburst, I reached down and switched off the small fan heater underneath the lamp to stop its currents of warm air from moving the shade. It was actually my neighbour who'd had no curiosity in this situation. He'd leapt to an immediate conclusion and dismissed all alternatives. When you label an event supernatural just because it has no explanation that's obvious to you, you'll inevitably misinterpret evidence and make invalid causal connections. You'll eliminate whole realms of alternative explanation before it's even clear which explanations might be appropriate, and that's the very definition of closed-mindedness. People who tell others to be more open-minded about so-called supernatural concepts often accompany this advice with one or more personal anecdotes they claim can't be explained. This is another flawed approach. Even if your experience can't be explained, that in no way strengthens the case for any supernatural concept. All it shows is that your experience can't be explained. Trying to suggest that a lack of explanation is evidence that supernatural powers are at work is actually a contradiction. In effect, what it's saying is, I can't explain something, therefore I can explain it. The unexplained is just that, unexplained. Furthermore, although it's quite reasonable to describe an experience and say you can't explain it, telling your audience they can't explain it is senseless, because your audience has no independent access to the events you describe, nor any way of investigating which details you may have missed or edited out. If my neighbour had told other people they had to accept his ghost story because they couldn't explain the moving lampshade, how would anyone be able to agree or disagree without knowing anything about the fan heater? Expecting others just to take your word that you've had a brush with the supernatural is simply unrealistic. Even if I saw someone disappear right in front of me, I'd recognise how unreasonable it would be to expect a complete stranger just to believe me without corroborating evidence, however personally frustrating that might feel. Someone once tried to suggest to me that scientists who ask for evidence before accepting claims are as close-minded as witch doctors. The idea that requiring evidence makes you close-minded is a fallacy. A willingness to consider new ideas doesn't commit you to accepting them unconditionally. If someone you love was lying injured and unconscious, and a complete stranger told you she had some magic powder that will cause instant healing if poured into the wounds, would you just accept this stranger's claim? Would it be close-minded not to let her pour a substance you know nothing about into the open wounds of someone you love? We're all sceptical about some things. If Alfie isn't sceptical about the existence of ghosts, and Beth is, it may be that Beth's experience of other people's flawed evidence and logic has given her strong reasons to be sceptical. Now, if Alfie develops a valid operational definition for what ghosts are supposed to be and produces valid evidence, Beth might one day reevaluate and accept their existence. But it's important to remember that unless Beth says something like, ghosts do not exist, she's made no factual claim requiring justification or indicating a closed mind. I've watched a number of people work themselves up into a froth about me having a closed mind on some paranormal issue, only to realise when they start listening carefully that I don't actually hold the views they've rashly attributed to me. For example, when I say I don't believe in something, I've not said it can't be true. All I've said is that I've not yet been presented with persuasive evidence for it. Now, if someone describes an entity to me that's logically impossible, then in those specific cases I might well say X cannot be true, and I'll back up my statement. But it's a classic debating trick to exaggerate and therefore misrepresent another person's position. And when you treat someone's statement of non-belief as an assertion that something cannot be true, this is exactly what you're doing. If you have difficulty accepting that other people don't share your beliefs, then that's unfortunate for you, because there's a lot of difference out there. But if knowing that someone's beliefs differ from yours causes you to lose a sense of perspective when talking to them, so that as soon as you hear certain trigger words, you start grafting inaccurately assumed attitudes onto them, you're no longer communicating. You're merely rehearsing your own prejudices, and that's truly close-minded. In the course of my life, I've been told to be more open-minded by people who believe in a god but not reincarnation, and people who believe in reincarnation but not gods. Both groups seem quite happy for others to express skepticism when they do, but not when they don't. For these people, open-mindedness seems to mean agreeing with me. Then there are others whose idea of open-mindedness is accepting the unreliable testimony of any random person with a spooky story. These people are often also fiercely sceptical of science. Certain comments can quickly reveal their poor understanding of what it is. And this results in two supreme ironies. One is that they're guilty of exactly the same sceptical attitude they criticise in other people. The other is that what they're reserving their scepticism for is a domain that emphasises scepticism. In other words, they're sceptical of scepticism. Again, open-mindedness isn't about believing things. So believing in more paranormal things than the next person doesn't make you more open-minded, though it can be a sign that you're more gullible. And despite what some people would have us believe, it's not a virtue to be easily persuaded by people. Those who say it is, and that requiring evidence is close-minded, clearly wouldn't survive one day in a court of law. After all, what does the person with that attitude do in any situation where there's more than one version of events? And is it close-minded to require evidence of someone's guilt before locking them up? These attitudes don't stand up for a moment in the real world. It would be absurd to suggest that we need evidence for everything we're told. When a friend tells us about their day at work, we don't ask them to back up what they say. And we don't stop enjoying films and stories just because they contain incredible events. But when someone's trying to persuade us to accept something as fact or take some sort of risk, Demanding valid evidence helps us distinguish true claims from false ones, and that's an invaluable ability in a world where believing false claims can seriously damage your wealth and your health. Critical thinking is not incompatible with open-mindedness. On the contrary, it empowers an open mind. Even though demanding valid evidence may lead you occasionally to reject ideas that are poorly supported but nonetheless valid, if and when evidence accumulates for those ideas, an open mind will allow you to reconsider them and possibly dislodge false ideas you'd previously accepted as true. This approach is promoted by science. By contrast, when you have an open mind but demand little or no evidence before accepting things, you leave your understanding of reality much more up to chance. Even worse, if you've accepted false ideas uncritically and close your mind to anything that contradicts them, you won't recognize true ideas even when the evidence is overwhelming, and you'll sabotage your own capacity for learning. If you believe in pseudoscientific and supernatural concepts, that's your privilege. If you want to put forward your personal reasons for believing in them, understanding that whoever's listening may have questions or find flaws in your arguments, that's fine. But if you're in the habit of targeting individuals you've never met and suggesting they're in some way deficient just because they don't believe in these concepts, if you reject conflicting evidence and counter-arguments without consideration, but demand that others accept your arguments and what you regard as evidence uncritically, not only is that closed-minded, it's controlling, arrogant, and presumptuous in the extreme. More importantly, when you're trying to make it seem unreasonable for someone to want evidence before changing a significant attitude or take a significant risk, the mere fact that your claim requires a suspension of critical thinking should indicate it's not the other person that needs to demand less evidence, but you that needs to demand more. Before presuming to advise others to be open-minded, think about some of the widely accepted ideas you dismiss without consideration. You might need the advice you're dispensing far more than other people. Remember too that an open mind that demands little or no evidence for ideas before accepting them will let in an awful lot of rubbish.
We'll be back after this break.
Winter weather got you down? Let the February issue of Discorder be the light in your life. Bringing you the same exclusive content in our exciting new format, this month's issue is filled with oodles of goodies such as shots from the DIY Fest Xenopalooza, the Groundhog Day staff sound-off, a calendar of all the best shows this month, and information on all the awesome swag you can win during this year's fun drive.
Are those CITR socks? That's bananas.
Plus band features on Hollow Moon, Connecticut, Redrick Salton, The Written Years, Vague, and Kubla Khan. All this and so much more in Discorder, that magazine from CITR. A copy can be picked up at any Friends of CITR business, or if you've gone paperless, check us out online at discorder.ca. And a very special thanks to our advertisers, the Biltmore Cabaret, Fortune Sound Club, LiveVan.com, MRG Concerts, the Portside Pub, Poster Loop, the Rickshaw Theater, Study and Go Abroad Fairs, and Weird Distro.
And you've returned. Since I'm sharing clips I like, I thought I would play this clip from The SciShow, also found on YouTube. I like their brevity, and they cover cool science. Here's a clip about taboo science.
It's because the Earth revolves around the Sun. Natural selection. It's how, like, species become new species.
Well, then it's okay to clone and genetically modify, like, crops and other animals, so why can't we do people?
Scientists really should be taking a better look at the...
What was that? Did I say something I wasn't supposed to talk about? Well, guess what? There's more where that came from, a lot more, and we haven't even mentioned the poop yet. You might want to get used to that uncomfortable feeling, because today, we're talking about the taboos of science. Now, hopefully you know that societies have a lot of hang-ups, like how people look and how they act and who they knock boots with, and it's mostly pretty stupid stuff. But taboos are no joke, they're powerful things, and when it comes to science, taboos can keep all kinds of things from being studied or even talked about. Take, for example, the story of Hungarian physician Ignaz Semmelweis. In the 1840s, Semmelweis had the audacity to suggest that doctors in maternity clinics should wash their hands before examining pregnant women and babies.
An act he correctly predicted would drastically reduce childbed fever mortality rates.
So how did his colleagues react to this advice? Not well.
His hypothesis that doctors' hands were somehow carrying diseases around and causing it in babies was ridiculed.
The germ theory didn't exist at the time, and doctors were offended at the idea of having to wash their hands, possibly also offended at the idea that they had previously been killing their patients.
So Semmelweis was fired from his hospital in Austria and faced so much harassment from the medical community that he was forced to move back to Budapest. After decades of anger and bitterness, Semmelweis was committed to an asylum where he died in 1865. Of course, it would only be a few years before Louis Pasteur would come around, confirm Semmelweis's findings with his germ theory of disease, and Semmelweis is now remembered as a pioneer in antiseptic procedures.
The story of Dr. Semmelweis helps illustrate the power of a taboo when social norms forbid a certain practice or way of thinking,
and the risks that come along with challenging a taboo.
In fact, there is a name for our tendency to reject a piece of evidence or new theory when it contradicts social norms, and it's called the Semmelweis reflex.
So yeah, science taboos have existed pretty much forever, going back to Darwin and Galileo and even the ancient Greeks. But what about today?
Here we run into a bit of a catch-22. By definition, scientists aren't willing to talk about taboos.
Sometimes just because they don't want to talk about it, sometimes out of a fear of losing their jobs or their tenure or their credibility.
But once you start looking, it's clear that almost every scientific discipline, from biology to medicine to astronomy to physics, has their own subjects that they like to keep hush-hush.
One person, really the only person, who speaks at length about scientific taboos these days is this guy named Dean Radin at the Institute of Noetic Sciences, which was founded to study consciousness and healing, missions that basically make the Institute a taboo in itself.
But no matter how crazy some of his scientific ideas are, his thoughts on taboos are actually pretty interesting. He breaks them down into three categories: transitory taboos, stubborn taboos, and super double secret super taboos.
Transitory taboos being controversial topics that gradually become less controversial over time.
Science has had lots of transitory taboos, practices that are not only accepted today, they're practically mandatory, like vaccinations, organ donations, blood transfusions.
At one time or another, all of these things were considered either medically impossible or dangerous quackery.
Today, there remain scientific procedures that are controversial but are still done, like embryonic stem cell research, or maybe even a better example, embryos that contain both human and animal cells, chimeras.
Now, the idea of fusing together different species is not cool with a lot of people, but it's done in labs around the world. Transplanting human stem cells into prenatal non-human animals allows scientists to study human cell development without directly using human embryos. So chimeras have been created fusing human cells with rabbits, and pigs have been created with human blood cells. And yes, there are mice running around in labs right now that contain human brain cells.
Now, let's start on this, where the conversation often turns to cloning, which is where you enter into some serious stubborn taboo territory.
Since Dolly the sheep became the first mammal to be cloned in 1996, scientists have cloned mice, dogs, cows, pigs, and the FDA has deemed that milk and meat from cloned animals is safe to eat and drink. You'd think it was practically mainstream.
Let's start talking about cloning humans, and you're not just talking about breaking taboos, you're probably also breaking laws. Research into human cloning is illegal in many countries, including all of the European Union, Australia, and Canada, and 13 states! But not here in Montana.
Oh yeah.
So why the taboo? Well, there are lots of ethical and religious arguments, but it's the biological arguments that really make the topic off limits, because cloning is hard and it's dangerous.
Attempts at animal cloning produce many dead, deformed, and diseased animals, not to mention lots of embryos and fetuses that are lost.
Cloning pioneer Dr. James Robel has said that in addition to those dangers and the low survival of offspring, you'd need a huge number of donor eggs and women willing to be surrogate mothers, which makes human cloning a really big problem.
And as far as we know, a human clone has yet to be born, though not for lack of trying.
In 2009, a Greek biologist, whose name I cannot pronounce, claimed to have cloned 14 human embryos and transferred 11 of them into 4 women.
He was either lying or the transfer failed. Either way, it did not go over well in the biology community.
But really, human cloning, it's just so last season as taboos go. If you're looking for a taboo for today's scientist. Allow me to introduce you to synthetic biology, otherwise known as extreme genetic engineering. This is an emerging technology in which genetic strains of organisms can be changed or created from scratch to allow the organisms to perform different functions, like new algae engineered to produce biofuels or bacteria altered to fight disease. In March of 2012, a host of different advocacy organizations called for a moratorium on the release and commercial use of these synthetic organisms and their products until regulations can be established. The groups also called for a ban on manipulating the human genome or the genomes of the microbes that live in or on the human body. Don't leave them out. So far, we've mainly talked about biology and genetics taboos, but what about taboos in other disciplines? Well, in the field of mental health, there's sex, especially anything other than heterosexual sex. For instance, gender identity has become less of a taboo topic in recent years, but many psychiatric organizations still classify gender dysphoria as a mental illness. So should, for instance, a child who doesn't identify with their physical sex be given drugs to delay the onset of puberty, giving them more chance to decide if they want a sex change? And then there's the question of whether sexual orientation is partially decided by your genetic code, or perhaps, more taboo question, should we even be looking for these things? Well, at least one study of gay brothers by geneticist Dean Hammer claimed to find a linkage between DNA markers on the X chromosome and male sexual orientation. In physics, you could argue that it's taboo to contradict Einstein. Look what happened when CERN physicists appeared to have clocked neutrinos moving faster than the speed of light, which is of course, impossible under Einstein's theory of special relativity. When the news got out that the scientists had made a mistake, which they pretty much already knew, the media went nuts with headlines like Einstein vindicated and Einstein owns CERN physicists from the grave. As for archaeology, it's practically off limits as an entire discipline in some cultures. In Israel, for instance, some ultra-Orthodox groups regularly protest archaeological digs because they consider it sacrilegious to disturb human remains. Now, finally, there are these supposedly double-secret super taboos, according to Dean Radden. Here he includes things like spirituality and consciousness, or what he calls psychic phenomena. Now, as far as I'm concerned, these topics don't have much to do with science, so I see them more as irrelevant rather than taboo. But maybe the most dangerous secret taboo in science today is what Radden and others have identified as the poo taboo. Now, this is an important public health topic that not enough people want to talk about and address because it has to do with poop, and that makes people uncomfortable. There are over 7 billion people on Earth, and only about 1.5 billion of those people use flush toilets that are connected to sewage systems, and that's just not right. Human waste is a major breeding ground for pathogens and parasites that end up contaminating ground and surface water supplies if it's not disposed of properly. And when it's not, you end up with a global sanitation crisis. Unfortunately, what has been dubbed the psychology of excrement often prevents solutions from being discussed on local, national, or global levels. It's proved to be such a frustrating taboo that some scientific and humanitarian groups have challenged it head-on, namely with World Toilet Day, which celebrated its 10th anniversary last November. It's basically a day to heighten awareness about a topic that people don't like to discuss and raise money for sanitation champions like nonprofits that help with public health needs around the world. So I say we take a page from the Toilet Day playbook and pull some important scientific taboos out of the closet. We're all adults here, right? But what do you think? I will say that as we were doing this episode, we had to, like, not include a bunch of stuff because it was way too taboo to talk about in a YouTube video, which is crazy because it's a YouTube video, right? But I'm curious what taboos you think we should have talked about.
Well, that's all the time we have this week. I'd like to remind our listeners that next week's show is our Fun Drive show. So please donate your money, get your wallets out, prepare to give. We hope to have host emeritus Ethan Cloud back on for a look at fantasy literature and how it relates to skepticism. This is Don saying, eyes open, minds on.
If you wish to make an apple pie from scratch, you must first invent.
Thanks for listening to Radio Free Thinker. Remember to visit us online at radiofreethinker.com and subscribe to the podcast on iTunes. If you have any local skeptical events you would like us to mention on the air, email us at info@radiofreethinker.com.
Venture to the stars. A still more glorious dawn awaits, not a sunrise, but a galaxy rise. A morning filled with 400 billion suns. Rising of the Milky Way. Cosmos is full beyond measure. Elegant truths of existence.
universe. We are in this universe. The universe is in us. Yes, the universe is in us. We are part of this universe. We are in this universe. The universe itself exists within us. We are part of this universe. We are in this universe. The universe is in us. Yes, the universe is in us.
Every atom in your body came from a star that exploded. You all started us. You all started us. From a star that exploded.
Look up at the night sky. We are part of it. The universe itself exists within us.
We are stardust in the highest exalted way, called by the universe, reaching out to the universe.
We are stardust in the highest exalted way, reaching out to the universe with these methods and tools of science.
Stand in the middle and enjoy everything both ways. The tininess of us, the enormity of the universe.
The atoms that make up the human body are traceable, to the crucible that cooked light elements into heavy elements. These stars went unstable in their later years, and then exploded, scattering their enriched guts across the galaxy. Look up at the night sky. We are part of it. The universe itself exists within us. We are stardust in the highest exalted way, called by the universe, reaching out to the universe. We are stardust in the highest exalted way, reaching out to the universe with these methods and tools of science. We are stardust in the highest exalted way, in the highest reaching out. The universe itself exists within us.
It's amazing to consider that I'm holding in my hands the place where someone once felt, thought, and loved for centuries. Scientists have been battling to understand what this unappealing object is all about. What the object is all about.
Here is this mass of jelly you can hold in the palm of your hand. And it can contemplate the vastness of interstellar space.
The brain has evolved from the inside out.
Its structure reflects all the stages through which it has passed.
Information in the form of energy streams in simultaneously through all of our sensory systems. In the form of energy.
Rather gruesome, wrinkles like a walnut, and with the consistency of mushrooms, like a walnut.
What we know is encoded in cells called neurons, and there are something like 100 trillion neural connections.
This intricate and marvelous network of neurons has been called an enchanted loom. An enchanted loom.
It is the most mysterious part of the human body, and yet it dominates the way we live our adult lives. It is the brain.
Listen, if they're so hot, how come they're not tearing up the charts?